Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Lin Shanjiang. Today, I'm delighted to have Dr. Melody Yunzi Li with us here on air. Melody, would you like to say hi to the listeners?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me, Dr. Zhang.
Dr. Melody Yunzi Li is an assistant professor of Chinese studies in the Department of Modern and Classical Languages at the University of Houston. Her research interests include Asian diaspora literature, modern Chinese literature and culture, migration studies, translation studies, cultural identities, and performance studies. She's the author of Trans-Pacific Cartographies, Narrating the Contemporary Chinese Diaspora in the U.S., which is the book that we're discussing today, and the co-editor of Remapping the Homeland, Effective Geographies and Cultures of the Chinese Diaspora. She has published in various journals, include Pacific Coast Philology, Telos, and others. Besides her specialty in Chinese literature, Dr. Li is also a Chinese dancer and translator. Actually, Melody and I share a long-standing friendship, and she has played a significant role as both a mentor and a friend in my life. Whenever I have the pleasure of seeing her, my instinct is to embrace her warmly and affectionately, refer to her as Jie Jie in Chinese, which means sister. I think we first met in one convention of Rocky Mountain Modern Language Association when I was still a newcomer in graduate school. Since then, our paths have crossed at various conferences where I've had the privilege of witnessing her remarkable presentations, such as Ha Jing, as well as Yan Geling, and also TV adaptation of Yan Geling's novel. Both these writers are key protagonists in her monograph that we are discussing today. So now we'll come to her book, Trans-Pacific Cartographies, Narrating the Contemporary Chinese Diaspora in the United States. This book examines how contemporary Chinese diasporic narratives address the existential loss of home for immigrant communities at a time of global precarity and amid rising Sino-US tensions. Focusing on cultural productions of the Chinese diaspora from the 1990s to the present, including novels by the Sinophone writers Yan Geling, The Criminal Lu Yanshi, Shi Yu, New York Lover, Chen Qian, Listen to the Caged Bird Scene, and Rong Rong, Notes of a Couple, as well as by the Anglophone writer Ha Jing, including A Free Life, A Map of Betrayal, selected TV shows, Beijinger in New York, The Way We Were, and online literature. Dr. Melody Yunzi Li argues that the characters in these stories create multi-layered maps that transcend the territorial boundaries that make finding a home in a foreign land a seemingly impossible task. In doing so, these maps outline a trans-Pacific landscape that reflects the psychogeography of homemaking for diasporic communities. Intersecting with and bridging Sinophone studies, Chinese-American studies, and diaspora studies, and drawing on theories of literary cartography, Trans-Pacific Cartographies demonstrates how these maps offer their readers different paths for finding a sense of home, no matter where they are. Without further ado, we will come to all the questions that I have for Melody. So the very first question that we usually ask is, what motivates you to do this whole research?
Thank you. This is my favorite question too, because this research deeply connects with my personal experiences with the Chinese diaspora. And as an overseas Chinese student, I actually grew up in an overseas Chinese village with my grandparents in Guangzhou, China. We call it Huaqiao Xinchun in Chinese. So not so much a village, but actually a community. There are a lot who went to Southeast Asia, like Vietnam, Cambodia, Singapore, Malaysia, and returned to China and built that village. When I went to primary school and middle school in that neighborhood, I often ran into classmates who have identity crisis or had difficulty defining home, especially when they travel back and forth between another country from Southeast Asia and China since they were young. That curiosity has taken root and developed when I went to Zhuhai for the first 2 years of my college. I entered as the first cohort in 2005 of School of Translation and Interpretation at Sun Yat-sen University, which locates on its Zhuhai campus. I was told that the reason that our School of Translation and Interpretation was built on Zhuhai campus for a very special reason, that it is the hometown for the very first overseas Chinese student to the United States, Yong Wing. And you may all know that Yong Wing came to the U.S. in 1854, graduated from Yale College, and wrote about his American experiences called My Life in China and America. Later on, I myself became an overseas Chinese student, coming to the States for a PhD, then stay here as a faculty member. During my time as a comparative literature PhD, I started to develop my personal interests in home and identity in my academic research. Gladly, my PhD advisors and mentors were very flexible and supportive of the idea of developing this idea. My PhD dissertation includes Chinese diaspora writers from the Cities to the Pleasant, but when I revised it into a manuscript, I have narrowed down to the scope of Xin Yiming, new immigrants literature, focusing on those who come from mainland China to the United States and the literatures by and about them in the 21st century. In both Sinophone and Chinese American literary studies, the scholarship on first generation Chinese American literature, especially the Sinophone ones, are far from sufficient. So I want to fill in this gap with my book. Therefore, the Trans-Pacific Cartographies is my attempt to reflect upon both my personal Trans-Pacific journey and capture the Trans-Pacific narratives that are not studied enough.
Yeah, this is really a fascinating story. And I think sometimes when I'm doing my own research, I keep going back to my childhood experience, and somehow we are all influenced by how we grew up. And now we really come to the title of your book, which has this very interesting word, cartography. And in your book, you keep mentioning the whole idea of mapping. So what does mapping or cartography work as your methodology to research into the Chinese diasporic storytellers and their narratives?
I owe this metaphor and theoretical framework to many theorists and critics whose works on literary geography and cartography inspire me, particularly Dr. Robert Talley, who is a mentor and friend of mine, is a key inspiration and guidance. Talley has built a definition of cartography upon the concepts of transcendental homelessness by Lucas, the existentialist, and the connective mapping of Frederick Jameson, connecting spatial representation and storytelling. Talley argues that the writer maps the world, I quote, coordinating the existential data of the individual writer's or protagonist's experience with the unknowable, end of quote. The cartographic narratives of the diaspora writers, therefore, can be read as a way of creating a path for their diasporic characters and themselves, making sense of the world and their place in it. And this is very important for me as a diasporic myself. And this is not through establishing one home or even one map. Rather, at times, they overlay the exotic maps of the US on their nostalgic maps of their homeland, at times adding on affected maps of their personal immigrant experiences, like I talk about in the new immigrant writings, and then other times drafting political maps between China and the States that fit over or beneath these others, just like Haji. And the diasporic narratives discussed here create various maps that deal with a new sense of Chinese American being and belonging that is not bound by territories, loyalties, or identities. Whether it's a palimpsest that overlays the Chinese dream onto the American dream, like I discussed the two TV shows in Chapter 4, or a tourist map that manufactured the effect of homesickness and lovelessness, like Chapter 3 about the new immigrant writing, or a multi-layered local global map like the others, they all make up a cartographic practice that connects trans-Pacific spatial and temporal sites. What these Chinese diasporic words capture is not a static map with fixed borders and national state system, but the complex flows across trans-Pacific and transnational spaces, the flows of the peoples and cultures and the linkages of borders that this population brings are the moving maps of convergences and divergences, an important part of global Asias as one of the key frameworks today that connects Asian studies and Asian American studies. So these different chapters that I examine deal with specific maps that capture interrelated yet distinctive flows, convergences, and divergences. I start the chapter one that challenged the physical territories and geopolitical entities by mapping out the emotional trajectory of the immigrant characters. So this chapter focuses on a specific national map, but also relates to latter local global map. So I argue that Hajin's work and life display a multi-layer local global map. And chapter two turns from the national map to the familial map to examine how this idea of home functions in China in a specific time. And chapter three moves more inward from the national and family maps to personal, intimate ones by exploring the sites of intimate love and romance. And chapter four turns to the cinematic and visual representation that I use the framework and metaphor of palimpsest map. And the coda examines the newest site, which the diasporic subjects can generate a sense of home that's like the virtual sense, like a virtual space.
Yeah, I think another key word that has been mentioned a lot of times by you already is this idea of home. So what does home mean for different generations of Chinese immigrants, especially the Chinese diasporic writers that you are working on? And also, you have mentioned this a little bit already in the first question, but I'm also wondering what does home mean for you to analyze all these writers?
Thanks for the question. And this is indeed at the core of my book. In my dissertation, actually, I just focus on the notion of home, but didn't use the mapping metaphor. So in the revision, I used a whole new theoretical framework, yet the notion of home still stands in the core of my book. In the cultural formation of home, the changing inferences of the traditional Chinese ideals of home in different generations give importance to my study. So we all know for the earliest Chinese immigrants, like the labor workers, laundry business owners, or the gold mountain miners, I think home often referred to their ancestral villages or regions in China. Despite physically residing in a new country, they maintained a strong emotional and cultural ties to their homeland. I think often that is because they face discrimination and exclusion, so leads to a longing for their native land that could be seen in the Angel Island poetry and all that. In my dissertation, I did include the overseas Chinese student writers, the Liu Xuesheng writers like Bai Xinyong, Yu Lihua, Lin Huailin, who went to the Taiwan after Chinese Civil War in 1949 and came to the States in the 60s. Those are proven to have a strong obsession with the ideal nationalist China, as well as a wish to return home. These writers often portray nostalgia for mainland China and their homesickness in their exile. My book now only focuses mainly on the immigrants coming from mainland China to the United States, but there is still a generation divide between the writers themselves. Some of the writers discussed in this book were born in the 50s and immersed in Chinese culture for about three decades before coming to the States. In the culture of that time, there was a strong attachment to and obsession with the homeland. many poems about like departure, farewell, or exile evoke nostalgia for the homeland or dying in a foreign land, like Ke Si Ta Xiang is portrayed as a tragedy. Yet today, the new immigrants no longer necessarily identify their homeland as home. Instead, they can see home as a cultural construct and as a sense of belonging that is found in their heart. As one of the writers mentioned, home exists in one's heart and its fluid cultural space. The new generation of the Chinese diaspora juxtaposes the seemingly opposite concept of home and homelessness. And in that juxtaposition finds a creative integration that breaks down the binary. So it's very interesting that these diaspora writers may depict home as a multifaceted concept in between home and homelessness, encompasses not only the locations, heritage, ties, but more so the emotional connections. I think studying this sense of home and belonging in Chinese diaspora literature means a lot to me, as I mentioned, since my own personal experience of growing up in overseas Chinese community in China evokes this question of home. And their writings also provide some insight in my own inquiry of my identity as Chinese diasporic and also overseas Chinese students, and most importantly, enlighten me to create home beyond national and geographical boundaries through our works like they do.
Yeah, I think it's really beautifully said. I also resonate with this a lot, especially because of that whole pandemic era that we cannot really go home that easily as before. And then I really dwell on this idea of home a lot because of it. And also I taught a whole course about narratives of home in Chinese literature and Chinese diasporic literature and culture as well. So I really feel this is a very important concept that we should think further about and really transcend what have been said before and how we can think further about it. And now let's come to another, I think, very important question when we think about literature, because the writers that you are working on actually use different languages to write. So what does the role of language or languages play in different writers' writings?
I actually started my academic training, as I mentioned before, in the School of Translation. So I was in translation major for both my bachelor and master's. So in fact, my master dissertation was about the translation and the back translation of Hajing's work, because one of the characteristics of Hajing's works is this foreignization. He has these Chineseness in his works, which appear really exotic for audience in Anglophone readership. So it's very interesting that how these foreignization would be, or could it be actually naturalized or retained when it's back translated into Chinese, which is the original language of that exoticism. So that actually led to my whole inquiry too into this language and interest. And I would say this is a topic that need to be continued to be dealt with. But to the Chinese diaspora writers, the choice of language is very crucial to their writings and identity. I think that depends on what kind of readership they decide on. So the majority of writers and shows I discuss in the book are actually written in Chinese, and because their target audience are either in mainland China or the Sinophone community around the globe. The only exception is Hajing, like I mentioned, but he's a big part of my work and also, you know, he's a main inspiration as well. And his choice of English writing strongly connects to his identity and cultural representation, because early on in his famous work like War Trash and Waiting, when he presents stories of the truth of China, he did mention that only the English language can penetrate into this cold core of truth, too brutal to touch with the warm heartbeat of a native language. So in some way for the immigrant writer Hajing, he came to his choice of writing in English early on, thinking this is a powerful tool for him to present this like truthful and powerful message about his homeland. So that's very interesting. And for the others, like Sinophone writers that I examined, however, They challenged the definition and boundaries of Sinophone very interestingly, because Shumeishi defines Sinophone as a network of places of cultural production outside China and on the margins of China and Chineseness. So we know that these writers would fit this, but by making this divide establishes the PRC-Sinophone dichotomy in the cultural domain. But the writers this book discusses grew up in mainland China, have studied and lived in the United States, and they further complicate this issue of Sinophone because they now write outside mainland China. Their words belong to what she first defined as the realm of Sinophone, yet the circulation and production of their work break down this binary. Some try to reach readers in their homeland by translating their words back in Chinese, even Ha Jing, even though he didn't get much success except for a couple works of that, but also publishing their words in mainland China, like Chen Qian, Shi Yu, mostly the writers in my first chapter, they published their words in China. So it's fair to say they articulate a different space of being and belonging that is more Chinese language, like Huawen, than China, Zhongguo. But yet through this Sinophone circulation of this cultural capital, they can reach their homeland in some way. Even for Ha Jing, who cannot physically go back to his homeland, he always mentioned that, you know, returning to home, it's through his literature. So that's his way of returning home. So while Shi's Sinophone concept is an oppositional term to Chineseness, and these contemporary Chinese diaspora authors I study redefine it as a literary and linguistic belonging that lies beyond the national boundaries. So their example really refutes this original irony of Chineseness and Sinophone, which is also the reason why I include writers that use both languages and get very interesting.
Yeah, I think the first part you mentioned about translation studies, and I think that's really important when we think about literature and how their literatures get transmitted. And also this forever debate about Sinophone, it's something that we always need to engage in. And I think you also add something new to how we think about different ways of interpreting Sinophone literature and Sinophone studies. Now we come to some of the specifics in your book. The very first question is Ha Jing, of course, and you have mentioned him here and there already. So why do you call Ha Jing as a map maker or literary cartographer? How does Ha Jing as an author exert his subjectivity by being a map maker? And how do his characters in A Map of Betrayal exert their subjectivities?
I'm so glad you bring this up. As I mentioned, Ha Jing and his works are one of the primary inspirations for my theoretical framework for literary cartography and geography. My book actually starts with a quote from Ha Jing's 2007 novel, A Free Life, when his protagonist poet Nan writes a lot of poems at the end of the novel. And in this poem, homework, like he writes, under his pen, a land is emerging. He says, I'm making a country. On the same map, he draws a chart. Railroads crisscrosses the landscapes, highways, pipelines, canals, etwine, and all that. So he really uses these metaphor of map to map his reality rather than being just a victim of the map, which we usually think about while having these boundaries and nationalities. And instead, he really uses his literature to prove this literary maps that's beyond geographical boundary. So he himself also maps out his literary trajectory through navigating different genres and themes. Also, a prominent example of his map making is through creating real or imaginary place names in his fiction. For instance, in his most famous novel, Waiting, the protagonist Lin Kang, an army doctor, leaves his family and wife from an arranged marriage in a rural village in a makeup city, Muji, and real place names also appear in his stories, like this Montfort, Golden County, and Dalian City. So I argue that Hajin's lives and words display maps that transcend geographical locales, physical boundaries, and political states. Instead of external geographies found on the maps, he invites us to turn to an internal geography that one could create with literature and helps us use these maps to construct our identities. And a map of a betrayal, I would say it's an epitome of that. He maps the split immigrant subjectivities through his spy character Gary, but most importantly, the map of betrayal has multiple layers that my chapter examines, including external geopolitical relationships between the US and China, the family relationships of Gary's descendants, and also his own internal geography. And this map of betrayal first consists of his relationship with the two nations, then with his affectionate relationship with his Chinese family, American family, and his mistress. Then his novel shows us a map without boundaries connected to patriotism and loyalties that are both personal and national. Interestingly, Hajin grants the role of cartographer not to Gary, but to his daughter, Lillian, who is a historian. So she is given the ultimate authority to draw an atlas of her father's complicated relationships on longing, love, and betrayal. Like Hajin, Lillian becomes a literary cartographer of her own, in the end learning lessons from her father and creating a new map based on internal geography beyond the physical boundaries.
Yeah, and now we transfer to Yan Geling's novel, The Criminal Lu Yanshi. I think I still remember the very first presentation I heard from you is about The Criminal Lu Yanshi. And I also remember when I was still in China doing my master's, the film adaptation of The Criminal Lu Yanshi, which is called Coming Home, was released on the big screen, and I went to the cinema to see it, actually. So it was quite touching as well. And then I think with all this popularity, I was really interested in your chapter about this particular novel. And one thing that I think it's really fascinating is really your analysis of the cultural experience and also its interrelations with the love relationship between this couple. So I'm wondering, how do these two experiences depicted in this particular novel create a different sense of home?
Yeah, so my chapter on Hajin shows how not allowing the strict boundaries between one nation and the other to dictate one's identity can provide a new home for an immigrant. Basically, we can create a home not bound by the territories of any nation, past or present. But interestingly, this chapter on Yan Geling and the criminal Lu Yanshi shows somehow the opposite, like how mapping one's home, especially for Chinese individuals, can be distorted when breaking the boundaries or barriers between family and nation, because that's a very specific time Yan Geling writes in. She was writing about the Cultural Revolution experience and the land reform of the character. So Yan Geling uses Lu Yanshi's imprisonment experience to signify a home experience that's problematic and traumatic. In some ways, very weird that like the character actually identify some of the experience in the prison as home, but you know, not exactly that kind of a sense of belonging, but more that a sense of familiarity. So that contradicts the comfort and stability that usually we associate with home. So the prison during the land reform is shown as a carceral dystopia that caused by the Mao regime. And Yan Geling portrays the dystopic spaces that are controlled by national discourse and authorities, showing the extreme way that the state has interfered with individuals' notions of the boundaries of their family lives. And their love relationship is part of that. Actually, that's the only part of the movie cut down to. The movie only focuses on their love and the memory after Lu Yanshi comes out of the prison. And of course, it has censorship issue, so they have to just focus on that. But that kind of love or inability to love or remember exactly portrays that how, you know, when a nation or national regime interferes, that's family boundaries, right? This carceral space made the love impossible. So basically, the writer points out when the state overlaps the bounds and interferes with the individual's family and love relationship, and then it will create a need, actually a diasporic need, to map with terrible consequences, like even within China's own borders, because this story actually is not completely like diaspora story, but in some way it is diasporic in the sense that like it creates such a diasporic need to create a home.
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating and also very much relate to what I'm researching into, because one thing that I argue during the war, it's really about diasporic in the homeland, right? You are not really at home because you are displaced by the war already. And of course, if we come to the experience of Cultural Revolution, then it's also about sending youth to different villages and countryside. And that's also kind of a displaced experience. And you are a diaspora in your home.
Exactly.
And then I think in your book, you come to more recent texts that you mentioned earlier, and also some of the new media forms. So I'm wondering, how are these kind of recent texts and also new media forms offer new possibilities of narrating and representing home?
Yes. So the new texts I examine in chapter 3 portray, like, they might have similar themes to other earlier diasporic novels, like interracial relationships, fascination with or debunking of the American dream, negotiation of cultural differences, nostalgia for the homeland, and so on. The interesting fact is these particular novels that I study, they do revolve around romantic love. I think in some way it may be their practical choice, just because that's kept them away from this sensitivity to politics of the two countries, especially their lifestyles living in the two lands. They travel back and forth, the new generation of cosmopolitans. But the focus on romantic love also marks a shift towards more personal and individual accounts in the Chinese diaspora literature that we have seen. Generally, the sense of home that these other diaspora Chinese words project is more informed by the national identification before. Even love, like in Hajing and Yang Geling's work, of a metaphor, and this negotiation metaphor for one's relationship with the homeland. But recent Chinese diaspora writers like these that I study in chapter 3 are more personalized and romanticized. So they're more of the contemporary, cosmopolitan, and free-spirited characters, just like themselves. And they define their sense of home and identities through their relationships and attachment as an end in itself. Instead of creating a map for the readers to deal with the existential crisis, these books commercialize the need for home and create more, I call it a tourist map for the reader, because the touristy narratives like often come packaged with promises of individual self-discovery, sexual and affective awakening. Instead of describing diaspora as a traumatic experience, these writers turn it into a medium for offering their readers a tourist-like experience that destabilizes the notion of homes for those who have not left their homeland physically.
I think this last question about your book is really kind of a feeling that I get when I was reading, especially your introduction and coda, which is really the pandemic that we just experienced. And reading what you were talking about makes me feel there's no reason. It's not gone at all, which makes your book so timely as well. So I'm wondering how pandemic influences the way you do your research and also write your book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's an important question. I think the pandemic caused some disruption of research and writing to many scholars, including me and my project. However, the pandemic also led me to have some new ideas and insights surrounding the idea of home, like you mentioned earlier, of your own experience, because during the pandemic, we were locked down at home, yet connected on Zoom. On the one hand, the physical connection has largely decreased, but the virtual connection did increase since then. And even now, I know, Lingshan, you have hosted many great online lectures, talks, interviews, which is amazing, just seeing how much you've done. So in some way, those little Zoom boxes reminds me of the transcontinental railroad train cars, because when we talk about the early migration, early immigrants, we often think about the transcontinental railroad, which is really a symbol of connecting different races and ethnicities. Yet the misrecognition or non-acknowledgement of the immigrants really show how alienated we are. So in the same way, I feel like we can sit on the same train in these different boxes, yet connected. The sense of alienation and connection, which has been the core of the diaspora community, actually expanded to the whole community during COVID. So I think you're right that in some way, understanding the belonging and voice of diaspora becomes more significant after COVID, as we might all be in some way diasporic. The introduction of my book that some newer theorists and critics explain the definition of diaspora as a sense of consciousness and sense of being. So these new situations caused by COVID like actually inspired me to write some part of my introduction and my coda. My coda focuses on the Chinese diaspora writers in pandemic times, because I think those writings are an example of connecting in a virtual world and creating a new identity in times when meeting in person is impossible. But with the technological advances and pandemic knockdowns, we have moved away from physical spaces and turned to virtual communities. But these writers like literary WeChat groups, virtual book sharing and talks, online conferences, open access blogs and journals all constitute new kinds of spaces where home and identity are formed. By reading these new immigrants' online created space, like I read them as liminal space because they are transitional in some way, and we can see the nature of these spaces as moving experimental nodes on the diasporic maps. I'm actually very intrigued by these new writings, and there's a lot out there, and I just finished another paper to continue this inquiry.
That's really fascinating. We are moving to our last usual question. What's your next research project?
I have two projects in mind. In addition to my work on literary spatiality and diaspora writings, I have started on this project that is more of a digital humanities and public history project that would be called or surrounding like mapping AAPI history in Houston. This project started from another mapping project I did during the COVID, which is the anti-Asian hate. We map anti-Asian incidents during COVID in California, Texas, and New York. And honestly, I was not too happy about the maps and protests we've done. So I think about like, how to re-navigate this project. So we want to map out the history of pan-Asian communities in Houston, starting from the history of Chinese immigrants in Houston. So it's actually now we have digital map component and also want to start on the VR AR component. And I'm recruiting free interns this summer to push this project forward. So I'm very excited about that. And also at the same time, as you know, and many have known that I love dancing. I've been doing a lot of like Chinese dance demonstration in different schools, and it's been part of my identity. So my next book project want to focus on dance. So which continues my inquiry into Chinese diaspora, but expands the scope to include Chinese dance. So want to see how dance serves as powerful symbol of Chinese diasporic experience that represent the intricate cultural identities of the Chinese diaspora. Over the past few years, during my time here in the States, I've done a lot of public lectures, demonstrations, and workshops on Chinese dance. So I hope that can bring together my creative activities and previous publications on dance halls in the subjects. And I want to study diaspora dances like Nora Lee, Carrie Lee, like Kun Yang, and literary media representation of dance, building on the existing studies of like Emily Wilcox or Sansan Kwan, and to see how Chinese dance can serve as a text to represent, challenge the cultural identities of Chinese diaspora.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I'm really looking forward to your new book project and also your public history project. Thank you so much for coming to New Books Network and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much, Lingshan. Look forward to next conversation.